kids. Matt Segundo here. Let it not be said that a woman, or for that matter, an ex-wife, can be easily impressed with a nice meal at a cheap Chinese restaurant. One would expect a certain degree of gratitude for handing over five hard-earned dollars for a beef and broccoli combo. One would expect perhaps a thank you for ensuring that the waiter came over to refill the glass of water. Yes, I realize the water is free, but it's the gesture that matters. I may not be made out of money, but I am, after all, a gentleman. And yet, these women simply do not recognize a kind overture when they see one. Which is not to suggest that our young roving correspondent's conversation with Jennifer 8 Lee involves similar snafus, but this litany of offenses merely suggests that when it comes to dating, men often get the short end of the chopsticks.
Okay, so I am here with Jennifer 8 Lee, who is most recently, the author of the Fortune Cookie Chronicles. Jennifer, how are you doing?
I am fantastic. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm doing great. I wanted to first of all ask, one particular comparison in this book struck me, and maybe we can use this as a starting point. Mm-hmm. You compare Chinese restaurants to open source software at one point, pointing out that ideas emerge from the wandering workers of these restaurants. Uh-huh. But I'm wondering if that's actually an apt metaphor, because open source software, as you know, starts from a kind of preordained Ubuntu CD. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering what would be the Ubuntu disk for Chinese restaurants? What would be the central hub?
Okay, so let's step back and explain the analogy to begin with. So the idea, the argument that I make is like, we respect McDonald's because it has standardized decor, dining experience, and menu across a very large network of restaurants. But it has done so through a standardized headquarters out of Illinois. Now, Chinese restaurants, which mostly do not exist in chains, have had largely the same effect, except they've not done it through a centralized network. In other words, for example, you can go into any Chinese restaurant, and without looking at the menu, you can be pretty sure they'll have egg drop soup, egg roll, beef with broccoli, General Tso's chicken. And to a certain extent, the fact that they've done it through sort of a distributed network as opposed to a centralized network is basically the argument that I make. So I compare McDonald's to sort of a centralized Windows kind of framework where, you know, change or things are kind of top down. And I compare Chinese restaurants to much more of a sort of Linux-y, open source-y kind of network where good ideas sort of are passed along. And that it's a very sort of flat kind of thing where there is a strong network. In my case, in the Chinese restaurant case, what happens is these networks are formed by immigrants, many of whom often come from the same villages. And as a result, because they have very open lines of communication, you can have things like General Tso's Chicken, which was introduced in New York City in the early 1970s, kind of walk across America within a span of 10 years, despite the fact that it started just with one, you know, chef who was originally from Taiwan in New York City. Or you can have fortune cookies, which started basically in California sometime before World War I. But, you know, in the 10 years following World War II, they went from largely something that was regional, mostly in California, a little bit in New York, to something that became nationwide. By the end of the 1950s, you had 250 million fortune cookies being made and sold across America. Okay, so we need to explain that to
yes,
the readers.
Well, that's true. But, I mean, in the case of General Tso's Chicken, you have mm-hmm. parallel iterations of that, which is why I sort of say to myself, well, if it's open source software and the General Tso's Chicken that ends up in New York is totally different from the General Tso's Chicken in China, that's why I sort of kind of get confused
right.
here.
Right, so the idea is that there is no... So one of the ideas is there is, of course, no General Tso's Chicken in China. I mean, it may have existed once, but if you go to General Tso's hometown, and you find
there
his relatives...
There is no chicken statue.
There is no chicken statue. Yeah, you
there
go...
is no great general statue. This was the man who brought this into the world.
Right. There
it's
is...
entirely a fabrication.
Well...
Mostly.
Mostly. I mean, a fabrication by whom to whom is sort of an interesting question. But yeah, if you go to... So let's establish who General Tso was. His real name in Chinese is Zhuo Zhongtang. And he is a famous Qing Dynasty military hero that played a large role in the Taiping Rebellion, which was a war that was started by a guy who thought he was a younger brother of Jesus Christ and also the Son of God. And he started a rebellion where 20 million lives were lost and is the largest civil war still in the history of the world because when Chinese people die, they die in vast, vast numbers. So General Tao played a large role in quashing the Taiping Rebellion and sort of uniting everything. Okay, so very well-known general. Does he eat chicken? Probably ate chicken at some point. But if you go to his village, you know, where there are lots of, you know, Tao family members still hanging out there, five or six, seven generations removed from the general himself, they're like, we don't know this chicken dish at all. I mean, I showed them lots of pictures, and they're all very confused by it. So you basically realize that General Tao in America is sort of like Colonel Sanders. He's known for chicken and not war, but in China he's actually known for war and not chicken. And so it says something, well, if this dish didn't really originally come from China, where did it come from? And so the deal is General Tao's chicken is most famous probably in America. Of all, anywhere, any country in the world, it is not really known in China. It's sort of a little bit known in Taiwan, but it really, really is known as the, you know, the chef special of Chinese restaurants in America.
And this is interesting in light of what we depict, what you depict, rather, what wasn't there actually looking over your shoulder as you wrote the book.
Right.
But what you depict with the fortune cookie, where we discover that, and you discover at the end,
yeah,
that actually these are recycled American maxims. The Confucius things which you dig up are actually, these axioms did not come from Confucius.
Right. So one of the points that I make in the book is, I basically kind of try to figure out, well, where does all the wisdom in the fortune cookies come from? And I go and I hunt down, the first thing I do, I figure out is, well, what did Confucius really say? So I dug up the Analects, which in Chinese is a book called Lun Yu. And I literally just kind of sat there. I have to admit, I read the translation. I didn't read the old, like, ancient Chinese version. And I kind of went through and highlighted everything that I thought would fit on a fortune cookie, which is, you know, he said a lot of stuff, not much of which fits on a fortune cookie, and not much of which is is relevant to Americans today. I mean, he said a lot of things about filial piety and running small governments, but not that much about, you know, future or you know, predicting things. And in the end, I came out with only about 40 fortunes. And now the thing to remember is that there are about 3 billion fortune cookies made each year in America.
Yeah.
And you realize that Americans, when they get the same fortune, they feel kind of gypped. Or if you get the same fortune as someone else at your table, you feel kind of gypped, right? Because we really value our individualness. And as a result, there's a huge, huge, huge demand for fortunes. You know, there's a they constantly need to, you know, freshen their fortune collection. Wonton Food, which is the largest fortune cookie manufacturer in America, has a database of at least 10,000 fortunes, right? So,
were you able to determine a master list of fortunes at
all? Yeah, they have a master list of fortunes.
Or did you actually, were you able to actually check this master list against other?
I do actually have. If you want, I actually can show you some of the master. I'm friends with the Wonton Food people, and uh-huh, you can listen to me take out my. I wasn't expecting to have to do this, but as a matter of fact. I have. You can explain to people what you said.
That's incredible. This is indeed. So this is, and then they change this particular. It's basically
a roll
of paper.
I think it's more than one roll. I think this is just basically.
This quarter's roll, basically.
Yeah, yeah. They have a database, but they don't run the entire database all at the same time. So explain to people what you see.
Well, anyway, I'm holding here in my hands a roll, which is rather. Sudden to
hefty.
Me. I can't.
Sort of like a toilet. I feel bigger than a toilet paper roll.
I feel like I've been let down.
Really?
I feel that now all of a
now
sudden.
Now it's like
all
standardized.
Fortunes, yeah, now every single fortune I could possibly get from a fortune cookie has been
revealed.
It's
now there,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
It's like no longer special.
Well, I mean, did you find out if you're friends with these folks? Did you find out if how often they rotate this?
Yeah, I think it's. I did, and I don't remember. I mean, I think it's like they have. I think it might be like once every 6 months. I'm kind of guessing, but I think they have like 3 batches or 4 batches and they rotate them through on a regular basis. And in the last couple of months, they've been experimenting with misfortunes, which doesn't go over well. Back to your original point. Where do fortunes come from? So who writes the fortunes? And
there is a number on the roll, too.
Lucky numbers, yeah.
No. I'm on the side here. It's just 15.
Oh, yeah.
So presumably that's
and
the 15th iteration.
And this is shuang. Means double, so I don't know why.
Double 15.
Yeah, I don't know why it's double. I don't know. It's kind of interesting.
Print this for 2 quarters. I don't know.
Yeah. So the deal is, I was like, okay, so what did the Chinese really say? And what I discovered, you know, and I went and found a whole bunch of, like, old Chinese pithy maxims. Like, they have, like, booklets of these, like, idioms and whatever. And if you're really educated in China, you're, like, forced to memorize all of these, you know, pithy maxims or whatever. So when you go and you find these maxims, you basically find out a lot of it doesn't make sense to an American audience, right? Because let's think about it. China, old traditions, very rural. So a lot of their wisdom has to do with agriculture. So, for example, there's a saying that's... my mom shared this to me. do not bend down and tie your shoes when you're in a melon patch. Right. So if you say that to an American, it doesn't really make all that much sense.
It makes sense to me.
It does.
Yeah.
It does make sense. What does it say to you?
Well, the melon patch is symptomatic of some very major paradigm in my head that if I were to tell you,
right.
I would start to tear up. It's a very emotional metaphor for me. And I kind of am sort of blushing now, just thinking
about
of my own personal melon patch. But now I know exactly how to go about the rest of the day, thanks to this piece of wisdom. You know.
So what this means to most Chinese people.
Oh, I'm sorry. I mean, I may be just a bit idiosyncratic. Go for it.
It means don't do anything that looks suspicious, even if it's not. But Americans don't grow melons, and they're not bending down melon patches, right?
Well, speak for yourself. Right?
Right. So that's one thing. And the other thing is China has a very sort of collective sense of wisdom and sacrifice, and it's about the family and not the individual. So another example, I love this contrast, is in America we have a saying that's the squeaky wheel gets the grease, which means, you know, speaking out is good. The individual gets sort of addressed if you proclaim yourself, right? And in Chinese, there's actually a very similar but slightly opposite saying, which is 枪打出头鸟, which means the bird whose head sticks out gets shot, which obviously sort of is trying to say something separate. So the point that I was like, huh, you know, like I went through and basically figured out a lot of these sayings don't really port over well from the Chinese to the Americans. Okay, so then where did the sayings come from?
Software verb here.
Right,
yeah.
Right. So where did the sayings come from? So where they do come from, you know, I found a whole bunch of fortune cookie writers who either look like you or look like me and speak like me. I mean, basically, they're people whose English is their native language.
That'd be a great job, I think.
Well, it doesn't pay that great. Maybe like...
Unless you're a big-time hack writer.
Yes.
It would be really fun.
Right. 70 cents a fortune, maybe. Maybe a dollar a fortune. Right? I mean, they're hard to write.
You could crack out about 100 a day if you really want to.
I don't know. If you got into that mood, if you got into that groove. I bet you could do it for the first 2 days. Third day, I challenge you. It's gonna be hard. Because it's really hard to write fortunes. I mean, you get kind of in a rut, I have to say. So anyway,
I was about to ask.
Do you know Facebook?
Yeah, I do know Facebook.
There's an application there called Fortune Cookie.
Yeah.
I wrote 2/3 of the fortunes in there because I'm friends with a guy named Max Levchin who started a company called PayPal, sold PayPal, started a new company called Slide, which makes like little doodads. And that was one of the first little doodads they made for Facebook. And so they needed fortunes because guess what? You know, Max and his employees are software writers. They're not, you know, they're not sort of sages. And that's where I come in. So actually for Facebook, I have like really fun things like, you know, you spend too much time on Facebook, or like, you know.
Well, that's not really a fortune, though. That's a bit of a cop out. You spend too much time on Facebook.
Yeah, that's
a misfortune to some degree.
I mean, like, you know, I think fortunes have stopped fortuning. I mean, they're really food for thought cookies, or they're sort of statement cookies or assessment cookies. I mean, there's really a limited number of things that you can say about the future, because you can basically say things about health, things about love, things about money. Things about your job, career, family, and basically up or down, right? You know, but the problem is Americans don't like sad fortunes, so you can really only say up. So given that, you know, you need thousands, if not 10,000s of fortunes, it's really hard. So you have to kind of start doing things that aren't just like about the future, right? And also the thing about predicting things about the future, it gets really limited because it has to be something that's generic enough for everyone.
Yeah.
So you will find the love of your life really bad if the man's already married, right? Like very different and also a little bit weird for a 6-year-old. So it's actually nicer if you just say, you know, great things await you. But there's only so many ways you can say that. Great things await you, you have great promise.
A thesaurus would be very handy.
Thesaurus is very handy. Anyway, so when you go ask these fortune cookie writers where they get their ideas from, they're like, well, you know, the Bible, Bartlett's Quotations. One woman was like, she got her ideas from the horoscope, which is why you have like, you know, you have a fair and sympathetic nature. Those things come from. Then another woman was like, television, the OC. For some reason, she mentioned the OC, which I thought was funny. She was young. Email forwards and movies. And that really kind of, you know, it didn't really strike me until one day about a year ago, more than a year ago. November of 2006 is in New Mexico at one of these fortune cookie Powerball restaurants where a winner, someone who had eaten there, had played a lucky number on a fortune cookie, went on to win second place in the Powerball along with 109 other people. I got do or do not, there is no try, which I don't know if you recognize, but that's basically something from Empire Strikes Back when Luke is on Dagobah getting his Jedi Knight training. And I realized at that point.
I thought that was from a Chinese poet.
Yeah. Well, Yoda is now our new Confucius, basically.
Yeah.
So the idea there is to convey that this is it. You know, Chinese wisdom doesn't work for an American audience. So what you really have in fortune cookies is things that Americans really want, and it's recycled through this sort of packaging to an American audience. But the Chinese are just a middleman. So they're sort of feeding back Americans what they want, but through the lens of exoticism. And that's sort of not only true for the fortunes and the fortune cookies, but true for food as well. Like, people think of General Tso's chicken as an exotic dish. But you know what? It's actually an indigenous ethnic cuisine in that it's ethnic, quote, but it really exists mainly in America. And that's not true just for Chinese food, but it's true for Mexican things like burritos and spaghetti and meatballs, which doesn't really exist in Italy. That was sort of something that was sort of pushed as a concept by our American government to encourage the skinny, sickly Italian immigrants to eat more meat. I think it was the USDA or whatever the president, you know.
But this is a sad story to me, because we're losing the melon patch.
Which
is infinitely more interesting to me. I mean, if I were to open a fortune cookie and it told me something about the melon patch,
yeah,
it would make me think. But now that we've reduced to these generalities.
Yes, well, that's the whole thing. Because the thing is, the fortune cookies, we think of it as something very individual. It's like you and the piece of paper and you have a personal relationship. But in fact, it's a very generic thing. It has to be a crowd pleaser, right? It has to be generic enough that it touches upon enough people, so that if it's a old black woman in the South, or, you know, a young Hispanic kid in New Mexico, or a yuppie that lives in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, that all of them can open up a fortune and get to the same and sort of not be offended.
Yeah. But the thing is that if the cookie is accommodating American culture, what does this say about American culture, or what does this say about the fortune cookie makers who were watering down these messages of melon patches? I mean, is this a problem?
No, I mean, I don't think it is. It's because there's a reason why fortune cookies are fantastically popular. I mean, like, let's think of it this way, right? If we were, you know, if our benchmark for Americanness is apple pie, how often do you eat apple pie versus how often do you open a fortune cookie? I would say most people probably encounter fortune cookies on a more regular basis than apple pies. And this is really interesting, because if you read my book, or I'll just give it away because I wrote a huge article in the New York Times about it, fortune cookies aren't originally Chinese. Like, there's nothing in Chinese desserts that looks like a fortune cookie, right? They're originally from Japan. They're actually still being made, a predecessor of it, outside Kyoto, or outside downtown Kyoto, central Kyoto, sort of technically, I guess, maybe still in Kyoto, at these little family-run bakeries, and they're really fascinating because they're made with miso and sesame, so they're brown instead of yellow, and they taste kind of different. I mean, they're a little bit savory, a little bit of a nuttier flavor. But if you think about it, the Chinese adopted the fortune cookies from the Japanese at a certain point because they saw how much it resonated with Americans. I mean, to a certain extent, my understanding of it, you know, based on the oral research of the post-war war fortune cookie manufacturers and restaurant owners, is that fortune cookies were sort of a regional specialty at the time of World War II. You know, they were already being served in Chinese restaurants. You could debate, you know, how they got there, and there are different versions of how they got there.
And you don't actually have a conclusive proof, because it could either be the Hong Kong Noodle Company, it could be Edward Louie and his great folding machine in the 60s.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of irrelevant. I mean, sort of, we definitely know it's from Japan originally. And at a certain point, they moved to to Chinese restaurants. How they made that transition are probably different, you know.
But I would put forth to you that where the fortune cookie came from is largely contingent upon how you define the fortune cookie, at what point it actually is the fortune cookie that we now enjoy.
Okay, go ahead.
I mean, so debate. I'm wondering, based off of that, could there be an origin in, say, Edward Louie? Or I mean, how would you determine who is the precise kind of originator of the American version of the fortune cookie?
Well, let's debate. I would say that they were already... So definitely not Edward Louie. That, in case you guys are wondering, Edward Louie's, that family was one of the first mass producers of the fortune cookie.
And that's a great folding machine.
It's a great folding machine. So I would say this. For a long time, if you want to really... go with, quote, fortune cookie. That's a Chinese name. Fortune cookies originally were called fortune tea cakes.
Tea cakes, yeah.
Yeah, they were called tea cakes. And that's really important, because guess what? Chinese people don't eat cakes with tea, but Japanese people do, right?
Yeah.
So as of post-war, still around World War II, the OPA, which is the Office of Price Administration, which basically did the price controls during World War II, in 1946, they delisted, quote, Chinese fortune tea cakes, which tells you a couple things. One, they were called tea cakes back then. Two, they were already known as Chinese. And three, they were popular enough to be regulated as a food product, you know, along with, like, I don't know, all kind of sauces, like weird pickled things. So at that point, they were still called tea cakes. And somewhere along the line, someone, probably the Chinese, decided fortune cookie was a better name for it. And it's really interesting. If you go back to the old newspapers, fortune cookie, it's C-O-O-K-Y and not cookie like I-E. And it's only later it picks up the spelling I-E. So fortune cookie as a term probably originated with the Chinese. Partially to sort of, I don't know, maybe tea cake doesn't sound as good. You know what I mean?
It wasn't so conclusive in your book, but I was curious if, for example, the persecution against the Japanese led to them appropriating the cookie.
Yeah, so basically my theory, you know, can I prove it? I don't know, but it's a working theory, is that fortune cookies were originally introduced mostly by Japanese bakers pre-World War I. Number of families make different separate claims. I think they're all probably largely true, because you can actually say, like, well, who was the actual first, you know, to the, look at the calendar? You know, I don't know which one. But there are probably independent claims to the introduction of the fortune cookie in California by Japanese families, and maybe even one by a Chinese family, okay, either in L.A. or in San Francisco. Then what happens is we do know that as of World War II, after World War II, they become very, very popular, partially because during World War II, you had a lot of soldiers going in and out of California because that was the major port to the Pacific Theater. They go eat in Chinese restaurants, so San Francisco is known for Chinese restaurants. They go home after the war, and they ask their local Chinese restaurant, why don't you have the Chinese cookies? And the restaurant owners in, like, Minnesota and Iowa look at each other and are like, what cookies? But, you know, because their network, again, back to the whole idea of, like, the peer-to-peer network thing, they go and ask each other and discover that, okay, these cookies are being made mostly in California, maybe a little bit in New York, and they march sort of from California to the rest of the country. And in part because the Chinese were so good at it, and they saw how popular they were. So the question is, well, how do they jump from being something that was made by Japanese to something that now is dominated by the Chinese? And when I went and found a whole bunch of these Japanese families, they basically said, yeah, we were making, you know, this is a family-run bakery. It's been around for 100 years, except for those 4 years when we were in internment camp in, like, Topaz, Utah. And so my theory is that basically when the Americans threw all the Japanese-Americans into internment camps during World War II, including those that made cookies.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then that's sort of when the Chinese moved in.
Ideas were ripped off.
Yeah, and so the Chinese, but it's interesting because, you know, the joke is like, well, the Japanese have been copying us for centuries, for all kinds of things. So the Chinese going to...
This could be why there's so much secrecy then in terms of finding the origin. Because, I mean, you write in the book that people weren't exactly forthcoming with revealing these origins.
Yeah, well, I think they just don't know. I mean, I don't think anyone has really taken a hard academic look. And I'm not going to say that my research is, like, rigorously academic and that it will stand up, you know. I don't think I could publish it in a historical journal. Like, you would have to, like, kind of go back and do a lot more cross-referencing.
What kind of doors did you knock down to sort of prove this hypothesis? Because, I mean, I know you went to San Francisco. You did go to Edward Louie's former stomping grounds.
Okay. So, I mean, are you interested in the research?
Oh, I'm interested in everything.
So we can definitively say fortune cookies are originally from Japan in some way or another.
Yes.
You know, one, two, or three. One, because they're still being made there. Two, there's a drawing from, like, the late 1800s of a man making fortune cookies in the same way they're being made now. So, okay, we know they're from Japan. We also know, as of World War II, marching forward, what their history is. They were already being made in California, and they sort of marched forward. And that's fairly easy to find because by the time the fortune cookies become popular, they're mentioned in newspapers. So you just go back and you look up old PDF OCR articles, mostly in ProQuest, and you see the mentions, and they pop, 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 and suddenly they pop, 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 really a lot more. I did find one article I did find one article that interviewed fortune cookie manufacturers in the early 1970s who were talking about how fortune cookies became popular after World War II. Okay, so we have that. And then another piece of the puzzle is all the Japanese families that you know, we were like, yeah, fortune cookies. And then came the internment camp. A lot of them still remember it. You know, big defining moment in Japanese-American history. And another important piece is that article that I found that said the Office of Price Administration was delisting Chinese fortune tea cakes in 1946. So at that point, what you can establish is that fortune cookies have already become Japanese. At that point, what you can establish is that fortune cookies have already become identified as something Chinese. What also I have is, you know, a bunch of families and whatever saying between in the 1920s and 1930s, fortune cookies were already being served in Chinese restaurants, mostly in California, maybe a little bit in New York. One, because Japanese people owned a bunch of Chinese restaurants, because back then people weren't eating raw fish. They weren't eating sushi. So guess what? They were selling chop suey instead. That's one. Two, there's an anecdote of a woman who is now dead telling a story about her mother, who is Japanese-American, going to Chinatown with her friends and, like, laughing at fortune cookies in a Chinese restaurant. Chinese restaurant owner comes over, says, "What are you laughing at?" She says, "Oh, these are fortune cookies. Like, where can I get them?" She's like, "Actually, at the corner of Souter and Buchanan." And then they see this guy buying up the fortune cookies on a really regular basis, sometimes buying them all out. And so we know, you know, before World War II, they've already become something. They've made the jump to Chinese restaurants.
But I'm wondering if you actually went in and tried to find documents, like, were there any order slips? Were there any kinds of manifests of some sort that you can at least kind of attribute this appropriation to, possibly?
I mean, no. I mean, it's a theory. You know, someone comes up with a better theory, that's totally fine. I'm not an academic. I mean, it's sort of, this is some of piecing together a story that makes sense, if that makes sense. I don't, you know, what you do have is these families with the black grill irons that are used to make fortune cookies. And they still have them three generations later. So, I mean, so the question is simply why. I mean, if your question is, did it make the jump? It clearly made the jump. The question is simply why it made the jump, right? Yeah. I mean, and to a certain extent, oral history from a journalist standpoint works. Especially oral history at the contemporaneous time that it was, you know, spoken about.
But it didn't quite work because we don't have an actual link, though. We only have
a
theory.
The link? What's the link? They made the jump. Okay, we know that.
We know they made the jump, but we don't know how they made the jump. And that's the question that...
But does it matter, like, how they made a jump? I mean,
I think so, because it's if it is possibly an appropriation, as we're sort of suggesting.
Oh, your alternative theory would be that the Chinese independently came up with fortune cookies themselves?
No. It's possible that they were appropriated, or I don't know. I mean, I'm just wondering, though...
So we know this. We know that the Chinese restaurants, pre-World War II, were serving fortune cookies. For two reasons. One, Japanese-owned Chinese restaurants owned served fortune cookies. Two, Chinese restaurants saw the fortune cookies being made by in Japanese bakeries and started serving them in San Francisco and L.A. This we know. So the question is simply, well, why did the shift happen such that the manufacturing was taken over by the Chinese?
Yeah.
So it's not a question how they made the jump, really, from something that was Japanese into something that was being served in Chinese restaurants. There are multiple sort of accounts of that. The question is, well, why did the manufacturing get taken over by the Chinese? And I think a pretty logical reason could be, if you don't have any Japanese people, there aren't any making fortune cookies. At the same time, you also have to realize that Chinese food experienced a surge in popularity during World War II. One of the reasons is because, one, China was suddenly our ally during the war. Previous to that, Chinese were sort of evil, Chinese Exclusion Act, all kinds of bad things, because they were taking away American jobs. But suddenly, like, okay, well, the Chinese are okay. Maybe their food's okay, too. I mean, so, one. Two, you have wartime rationing, and Chinese food makes a little bit of meat go a long way.
Yeah.
So what we do know from, you know, I don't know where this academic found it, but basically, if, you know, an academic account that says between 1942 and 1945, the demand for Chinese food in San Francisco's Chinatown tripled. So you're seeing suddenly a large demand in the growth in Chinese restaurants. And, you know, can you make, you know, if someone can come up with a better theory, power to them. That's fine. I'm all open for academic debate.
Fair
but
enough.
I think this one kind of makes sense.
Well, if chop suey, let's go to another topic.
Okay, sure.
We talked a lot about it. But if chop suey is the kind of the great con that lasted for so long, will we see General Chow's chicken be kind of identified as a big phony in about
maybe
two decades?
Okay, so...
I mean, can you predict any particular dishes right now that show signs of, well, wait a minute, this
beef
is
with
a bit...
broccoli.
Yeah?
Broccoli is not a Chinese vegetable.
Yeah.
Guaranteed, General Chow never saw a stalk of broccoli in his life. Broccoli is originally from Italy, came over to America during the 1800s, but really became popular in the 1920s, largely thanks to an Italian farming family that did a great job marketing it. Got a surge and became a mainstream staple in the 1930s after World War II with all of the servicemen returning from Europe who had eaten and encountered broccoli in Italy. There was a sort of surge in popularity there, too. So the Chinese now have discovered broccoli, but it's sort of an exotic vegetable. It's definitely not something that's very common. But we think of beef with broccoli and chicken with broccoli as very, like, staple American Chinese dishes, but in fact, at least my friends have never seen, you know, from China, never really eat broccoli. So anyway, going back to chop suey, the point that my book makes, as most people know, is, you know, chop suey isn't really a dish that people in China eat. It's actually chop suey comes from the Mandarin, which is zha sui, which means basically odds and ends or bits and pieces. But this dish, when it was introduced in the late 1800s, almost at the turn of the 20th century, became this phenomenon in part because it used a recipe and formula that Chinese restaurants here and around the world continue to use to this day, which is it takes something which is safe and familiar and packages it with something that's exotic. And that's a very appealing thing. So chop suey basically took vegetables that were different textures and, you know, fun, like squiggly bean sprouts and crunchy water chestnuts and snow peas, and it mixed together with meat that was clearly recognizable to Americans. So chicken, beef, pork, whatever.
In a way, it's sort of the missing link so that Americans can go on to more exotic dishes of Chinese cuisine.
Maybe. Some do. I think people's natural curiosity towards experimenting with food reflects their natural curiosity with exploring the world. And I think there's a pretty good, there's a pretty tight correlation. Not exact, but a pretty good one. So anyway, I make the argument that chop suey is the biggest practical joke that one culture has played for another. It actually took them about 30 or 40 years before the Americans realized, like, what do you mean chop suey is not China's national dish?
Yeah.
And it was really funny for them to finally realize that. So, you know, these dishes, again, we return to the theme that these dishes that we think of as, quote, Chinese, beef with broccoli, General Tso's chicken, chop suey, fortune cookies, are things that are alien to a Chinese person living in the middle of China. I mean, they've never seen General Tso's chicken. They're like, what is this? Why is it so goopy? Why is it orange? Why is it on a bed of broccoli? Yeah. And the whole book of the point of the book, actually, ultimately, is to make people think twice about what it means to be American, right? You look at me, you can see me, I look Chinese. If you close your eyes, like you're, or if you're, you hear me on the radio, I sound American, right? And so, again, what are our assumptions of what it means to be American? I'm as American as probably anyone else at my age that's born here, maybe. Well,
unless you throw those assumptions out the window and just essentially accept human beings as human beings, as I do.
You clearly are sort of on a higher, like, spiritual plane than most of Americans. I would say most people let... No, I mean, I would say most people, for better or worse, let the ideas of race and class color their assumptions about people, fairly or not fairly. I know I do it. I don't necessarily do it in a negative way, but I'm sure, you know, you take the fact that you're a guy instead of a woman sort of makes it probably more likely that you do X instead of Y, you know, like you probably didn't play with Barbies when you were little.
But I did, actually.
Did you really?
Yeah, yeah,
so
I did with some little girls down the street. I was a very strange kid, though. Yeah.
But that's great, because now knowing that you are a boy that played with Barbies
also tells me something. This is probably why, I mean, that's why I was interested in your book, because I've always been curious about different types of food. I mean, speaking of exploring the world, I wanted to sort of ask you, I mean, you spent a lot of time and resources going to many countries for this, including finding there's this lengthy chapter trying to find the greatest Chinese restaurant in the world. But I mean, I'm
outside
wondering...
Outside China.
This, you went all over the place. There's a laundry list. Yeah.
Mauritius, Dubai.
Yeah, well, I know. And I'm wondering...
Australia,
I mean,
New Zealand.
Did you do this in tandem with New York Times reporting? Or
no.
How did this go? I mean,
no,
that's a lot of
money.
It's
very rapid. It's a lot of money. I think that one chapter cost more than the rest of the freaking book combined. Mm-hmm. It was. Which is very efficient. I mean, I also stayed in a lot of people's couches. Like in Mauritius, it turned out that, like, one of my friend's cousin happens to be the number two at the U.S. Embassy there. So I got to stay with them for 4 days. You know, I crashed in someone's couch in Italy and in France and England. So that was okay. And I dragged my sister to Brazil and to... Australia. I think I dragged her somewhere else. New Zealand. Yeah. And then India was cheap and Dubai was not so cheap, but I was only there for 2 days. So, I'm Chinese. I'm frugal. So I did it for as cheaply as I could do it, basically.
But I'm wondering, though, in terms of celebrating, I mean, we've clearly established that there are different types of Chinese restaurants all over the place. And is it really sort of fair to Chinese cuisine or any kind of cuisine, or American-generated cuisine that happens to be served in Chinese restaurants? Is it really sort of fair to declare this is the number one restaurant? Is that, that's a bit American in
Well, I think it's the greatest Chinese restaurant. I mean, I think I make a rigorous case for why that is. And you, people would have to read the book as to why I selected this restaurant. And I don't say it's the best. I just say it's the greatest. There are different ways you can be great. And, you know, next time someone else travels to six continents and 23 countries to determine their pick of the greatest Chinese restaurant, power be with them. We can discuss our options. And since then, you know, there have been other great Chinese restaurants, really good ones that have opened up. I know there's been one that opened up in Dubai called Noble House, which is supposed to be incredible. I won't get a chance to try that. But, you know, I think the book is less, I mean, that chapter is less about, like, picking the specific one. Then it is sort of a parallel tale of the Chinese diaspora. Remember, Chinese food served on all seven continents, even to Antarctica, right? Even in space. And the idea there is that if I told people, I'm going to tell you a story about Chinese diaspora, like, you know, the fact that there were, like, famines and floods in the mid-1800s that drove a whole bunch of Chinese people to Singapore, not that interesting to the average American. But if I said, oh, my God, Singapore has some of the best Chinese cuisine in the world, and this is why, suddenly a lot more interesting, right? So I believe in this idea of edutainment. Which is, or infotainment, which is basically, you know, I take something that I think you should learn, I turn it into a way that's palatable to the audience to read. And sort of that's a little bit like, you know, Chinese food, taking something that is sort of, you know, something and transforming into something that's palatable and appealing to your audience.
But there's also hard journalism to some degree in this, too, in terms of exploring the...
That's true.
...the smuggling and...
Most people don't ask me about that. We spend a lot of time on General Chow's Chicken and Broccoli,
well,
not a lot on the illegal aliens.
I'm trying to cover as much territory
as I
can.
Not you,
I
mean just in general.
Yeah.
I've done, like, so many interviews, and everyone's like, fortune cookies, General Chow's Chicken, da-da-da. But a good bit of my book is actually fairly serious.
There is, though, an ethical dilemma. Now when I go to a Chinese restaurant, I'm based off of these chapters, knowing of what
tip
you
better.
Well, I always have been a very good tipper, but I mean the point I'm trying to make here is that you had undercover this underground network at Manhattan Bridge. You have a whole bunch of Chinese workers who go in there who are basically disseminated across the nation, going to various restaurants across the country. But you know, it was very intriguing to me. I wanted to ask you a question about this because, as you may know, the New York Department of State Labor actually does not ask workers of their immigration status.
Mm-hmm.
And these workers have to work long hours that for very little pay often. And I'm wondering if you uncovered any particular attempts by them to complain, or are they just
Well, there have been a bunch of... around the country, there have been, a bunch of strikes and protests by Chinese restaurant workers in New York City, organized by Chinatown worker. I don't remember the name of the organization, but a whole bunch of like advocacy groups have helped organize Chinese restaurant workers. Some of them have actually formally sued both in state and federal court. There've been a bunch of boycotts. Some of the things have been taken in front of the National Labor Relations Board. Is that what? And so, yeah, and not only that, but there have been federal cases of where the government has come down against people who've harbored a whole bunch of Chinese illegal immigrants. If you just look up, like, you know, Chinese restaurant worker, you know, prosecution on Google, you'll see a whole bunch of things, you know, ranging from Texas to Ohio or to wherever. I mean, to a certain extent, the government has, I mean, I hope our federal government has better things to worry about than cracking down on illegal restaurant workers, except of course when there is examples of gross abuse, which sometimes does happen. But you know, in the situations that I largely observed, they were being treated sort of okay, mostly in some cases because they were friends and family. Like, you go work at your fellow villagers' restaurant, so you're not necessarily as vulnerable. That's not always the case. Some people are actually kind of fairly poorly treated, but guess what? You can then leave and get another job because there were Chinese restaurants all over the country, all looking for walk chefs, all looking for delivery men, all looking for waitresses, all looking for people to answer the phone. You know, it's tough. It is not an easy life. They spend a lot of time on their feet and a lot of time away from their families.
But they've also got this remarkable debt hanging over their shoulders if they have been smuggled in, like $20,000.
Yes.
The
going rate, $74,000 to $76,000, to be smuggled from the region of China where most of them are from now, Fujian province, to New York City. That's
but certainly
a lot of money.
These restaurant managers obviously know of this. They have to. And so I'm wondering whether they are really treated well if they know that they have to constantly work and they're essentially sort of being exploited to some degree.
Treated great. I mean, life sucks in many different ways. They're definitely abused. It's sort of like, you know, the same thing with Mexican workers in agriculture and restaurants. You know, you and I probably lead pretty charmed lives in comparison. And, but it's interesting because a lot of them choose to come here because it's what is expected of them and it's what is necessary. Life in China, you know what? It's a lot better. It's a lot more comfortable now because whereas those areas of the of China used to be very, very poor, in the last 20 years, they've become some of the most affluent parts of China outside, you know, like the major cities, because there's been so much money that's been sent back by these restaurant tours and restaurant owners and restaurant workers that there are these towns that have these mansions. They're ugly, by the way. They're like inside out bathrooms. They love tile. 5 stories high, 4 stories high that are built, you know, by the money that you and I spend on General Tso's chicken.
But here's the thing. They're not only are they sending back money to their family in China, but they are also trying to pay off this enormous debt, you know, in some sense. So it's like, I mean, what is the value of such a life? Why do they keep on coming to America for this mythical opportunity?
Well, I think a lot of them don't realize how bad it is. So that's one. Two, again, this gets back to Chinese culture. Your life is not just your own. In America, we think of it as such because we're very individualistic. But in China, you have an obligation both to your parents and to your children. So some of them come here because opportunities for their children will be better. Some of them come here because, you know, they have to work hard in order to support their parents. And the most efficient way, you know, is to work in a restaurant. I mean, if I told you, barring like, you know, really, there are pretty horrible things happening in Iraq. But if I told you, you could make $1,000 a day working in Iraq for, you know, one of the contractors, you'd think, you know, it's kind of dangerous. Life kind of sucks. That's not bad, $1,000 a day.
Depends on what your priorities are. I wouldn't do that.
Right. But I think there's a lot of people who do, you know, in part because that money is, you can save up a lot of money that way in a fairly short period of time. Great risk to yourself, maybe. But if you had to support your family, your parents, you know, it's not necessarily looking like such a bad deal.
I'm wondering,
I mean, I wouldn't do it either, but, you know.
I'm wondering if you uncovered any particular communications along these lines of Chinese illegal immigrants in America communicating to people
China?
In China there may have been email, but I mean, did they communicate like, hey, this is a really hellish life I'm leaving?
Sometimes
or
you
was
don't...
this just not kind of accepted that you couldn't complain?
I'd say both. I mean, some people you don't tell them how bad it is, and sometimes it's the parent, the grandparents come over, and you know, the parents of the illegal immigrants come over, and they see in like the horrible situations that they have to live in, like very, very small apartments, cramped, dark, working all the time, and they're like, "Wow, America's not the beautiful country we heard it to be." Because I don't know if you know, but the name for America in Chinese is Meiguo. Mei means beautiful, and Guo means country. So Meiguo is technically beautiful country. So in some people's idealism, when you watch it on TV and you see it on Friends and you see it in like movies, you think of it as this idealistic rich country, but the lives that they live here, a lot of them, it's fairly humble. Some of them have been able to climb out and have fairly decent lives too, because again, the Chinese restaurants are about a foothold in the American dream. But it's definitely not great.
I'm wondering, though, then why did you portray Michael, who is this success story, who has an apartment?
And a house, and he's doing well.
But I mean, there are probably a number of, as we've sort of established here, a number of people who aren't so doing so well.
Right. So there are 3 chapters about illegal Fujianese immigrants.
Yeah.
I think 2 of them are fairly negative, and the 1 for him is fairly positive. So that's, I mean, you need 1 happy one.
Is this the risk of edutainment, or?
Which part?
This notion of portraying the happy over the reality.
I mean, you know, some people are happy. That's the one that I chose. It happened to be happy. You know, and we have another chapter on delivery workers and how much their lives suck, including this guy who everyone thought was murdered because he disappeared, but then turned up in the elevator 3 days later. And then we have another story of a family that almost broke apart because they moved from New York City to Georgia to run a Chinese restaurant, and sort of pressures of, you know, running a small restaurant in a rural community where they're sort of outsiders and no one knows them and no one trusts them. And, you know, when the government comes and takes their kids away for neglect, I think that's really interesting. So whatever, you know, you win, you choose sometimes the best stories, you know, and Michael happened to be one of the best stories. There are tons of people on the Golden Venture. He's one of the few that owns his own restaurant.
Yeah.
You know, also, I chose him because he came from this town called Hoyi, which is one of the earliest towns that sent large numbers of people to America. Okay. So I wanted to connect it to that.
While we're on the subject of delivery men, I have to ask you about Misa Chang. There's one thing you didn't note in this. You suggest that she was essentially using spam at the right time at the right place.
So let's make the comparison. Basically, that her use of delivery menus,
the bane of all New York apartment dwellers,
was sort of like the early prototype of spam, because basically she used vast numbers. It was cheap. People didn't want it, but it didn't matter that she kept on going.
Yeah, but what I'm wondering is you didn't factor in pizza delivery, which was emerging roughly around the late 60s and the early 70s, and in fact was fairly omnipresent, and I wanted to ask you
I think the difference is right. So delivery was available, I think, but the question is whether or not they were aggressive. I don't think they were papering in the same way. I mean, I don't think of pizza menus being shoved underneath my door, because you know, you basically, it's fairly predictable what you can order from a pizza, you know, a pizza place. It's small, medium, large, pepperoni, onions, blah blah blah, you know, sausage, whatever. So I don't think they necessarily needed to have the same sort of aggression. She's not the first person to do delivery. I mean, delivery was sort of existence, and you know, since the 1930s.
But in this aggressive manner, essentially.
In sort of this aggressive manner, in this sort of almost warlike manner, and sort of spurring the delivery revolution, because you know, pizza historically may have been delivered, but sort of it was limited to pizza, because just the notion of pizza delivery, you know, in this box is a very specialized kind of industry, right? As opposed to Chinese restaurants, that sort of push in delivery also triggered Indian restaurants, Thai restaurants, Japanese restaurants. Now, I would say a good majority of restaurants in New York City, if they're going to survive and they're going to be decent, have some form of delivery.
But see, I have a theory about this, delivery I want to ask you about, is pizza versus Chinese food.
Yep.
I mean, pizza is essentially, it comes to you, it's for a large group, you can take a slice as opposed to opening and scooping some rice onto a plate.
Right.
And I'm wondering if this reality may have factored into why it happened to take off in New York at that particular time. Whether a lot of perhaps single people or people who wanted to sort of share it or did want to go to that extra effort in order to eat the food, whether these factors might have also contributed
to that. I think you make a point, which is that one person eating a whole pizza, a little bit weird. But, you know, one person can get delivery and feel okay about it,
yeah,
if that makes sense. Also, you know, pizza doesn't feel super healthy. I mean, Chinese food isn't really... American Chinese food isn't also really super healthy, but at least it comes with vegetables, so some people think of it as a little bit more healthy. But yeah, I think pizza, you know, pizza also very important in the whole delivery culture in America.
But I'm also wondering if you learned from Misa Chang whether single people or couples had a better sort of regular delivery families or whatnot.
Well, no, one of the main reasons delivery was sort of pushed as a phenomenon is, guess what, during the 1970s, a whole bunch of women were entering the workplace.
Yeah.
So they needed to have a way to feed their families. You know, back, you know, 1950s, idyllic or not, you know, real or not, the myth is, the woman stayed at home, she cooked dinner, and so when the guy came home, he got his slippers, his newspaper, and his pipe, and dinner was all ready to go. If the woman's not at home, dual income family, someone's got to feed the kids. And guess what? Delivery was there, ready to go.
Gotcha. Well, I mean, did you determine anything beyond this aggressive flyer strategy from Ms. Chang?
In what sense? She did?
I mean, like, what else she did? Or did she target specific sort of people in terms of keeping regular
customers?
I just
think Upper West Side is a sort of a very, you know, during that time was pretty professional and full of young professionals, not necessarily yuppie in the same sense that we think of today, because this was the 1970s and the Upper West Side was a little bit mixed. You definitely had a lot of students. You know, basically anyone who's looking for a cheap, hot, fast meal that's convenient, that's brought to their door.
Okay. Well, Jennifer, it was a pleasure chatting with you.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Yay, all fantastic. Right. Thank you. How long was